Well, among the many images that have emerged from Ferguson, Missouri, perhaps some of the most arresting are those of law enforcement personnel lined up in riot gear, helmets and vests, batons at the ready, and right behind them, the sight of an officer atop a military-grade armored vehicle holding a sniper rifle. What does it signify when law enforcement looks more like a military deployment? We'll be discussing that in just a few minutes. First, though, we're joined by KCUR's Peggy Lowe, who has looked into the acquisition of equipment by various law enforcement agencies in Kansas and Missouri through the Department of Defense's 1033 program. Peggy, always good to have you here.
Good morning,
welcome.
Steve.
So the Defense Department's program 1033, if I get this right, allows the DOD to unload some of its vehicles and equipment to law enforcement agencies throughout the country. What are some of the bargains that police and sheriff departments can acquire through this 1033 program?
Well, it's a basic, you know, they have surplus stuff that they can then transfer to local law enforcement agencies. So it can be as benign as computers and desks and pants, you know, things like that. And then
gotta have them.
Yeah, you gotta have them. And then the other side of it, though, is that they have, you know, weaponry. They have armored vehicles. They have aircraft, body armor, night vision goggles.
And this is left over from Iraq. It's left over from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. It's just, this program started in the mid 90s. And so they've been giving this away since then, but it's really ratcheted up in the last few years because, of course, there's been a de-escalation under the Obama administration.
And this costs local agencies what to get this fancy equipment?
Zero. Nothing.
Zip.
It's free. Yeah. So it is a heck of a bargain. Basically, it's shipping and handling, to use kind of a joke here. They have to go get the equipment or get it shipped to them. So the local law enforcement guys have to pay for that. But otherwise, it's free because what it's considered technically is a transfer. So DOD still technically owns it. They could take it back if another war breaks out, but they never have.
Well, you obtained some eye-opening lists of what's been acquired in Kansas and Missouri, and I've got to say, I'm curious why Ford and Saline counties in Kansas would want grenade launchers, one each, but seriously, why would some of these departments in more rural areas want an armored vehicle, of all things?
I know. I was really, really surprised about that, too. They're called MRAPs. It's Mine-Resistant Armored Personnel Tank or something like that. And for instance, Coffeyville, Kansas has one. They got one. It's like not even 10,000 people in this little town. And what they have said is, you know, if there's an armed shooter, you know, and they call it active shooter, I think that's a technical term.
Yeah.
You know, our guys would be protected. And then if we could get, say, a hostage out and put that person in, then they'd be protected. Other guys out, say, in Western Kansas and in Missouri, too, have said, hey, if there's another tornado like Greenberg, you know, this could be an effective tool for getting people out, that kind of thing.
And closer to home, Peggy, the Jackson County Sheriff started taking advantage of Program 1033 back in 2009. And do I have this right? With bridge erection boats.
Yes.
And the department continued supplying itself from the program as late as April of this year. What were some of the more popular items on Jackson County's shopping list?
Well, this last one in April was this mine-resistant vehicle, these big vehicles. But that's the second of their armored vehicles that they got in Jackson County, which, of course, is Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah.
They got a robot explosive ordnance device, and that might have actually been in the Kansas City Star this morning because there was a suitcase that they had to check out yesterday downtown. So when I saw that, when I saw that photo this morning, I thought, I bet that's the stuff they got from the DOD. They got, you know, sights for ammunition. They got four trucks. They got night vision goggles. They got four of those. And what's interesting, too, about Jackson County, I have called them three times, and they won't call me back about this. I don't know why. They don't want to talk about it, and they don't want pictures of it. The rest of the agencies, at least in the metro area, have been pretty great. And, for instance, I went up to Clay County yesterday and hung out with them and saw their MRAP. So, I don't know. Jackson County doesn't want to talk about it.
So, basically, bottom line here is that some local departments could basically match what we're seeing in Ferguson of late.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there have been records checks on the Ferguson request. They did not get MRAPs. But, you know, when these things happen, all local agencies will swarm in and come help. So we believe that that's where they got those. Also, Jefferson City, that county, mm-hmm. has gotten a ton of stuff. They got the most stuff of anybody
in Missouri. With the state capitol being right there.
With the state capitol. And we presume, perhaps, the state highway police also.
Well, you can find Peggy Lowe's full report on the Department of Defense's program 1033 at kcur.org. And you can comment about it on our our Facebook page. Peggy, always good to have you.
Thanks
for coming
Steve.
In. You bet. Now we turn our attention to what's being labeled the militarization of law enforcement, the hardened response, such as that seen in Ferguson. We start with you, the listener. This week's Tell KCUR is asking this question: what can Kansas City learn from events in Ferguson? Tweet us with the hashtag TellKCUR hashtag or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. You can also leave us a message at 816-235-2881 or send us an email with your answer to social@kcur.org. And here to help us understand some of what is behind the response of law enforcement in situations like that in Ferguson are Ken Novak. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UMKC. His research and teaching focus on policing in America and police and the community. Ken, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Steve.
On the phone with us today, Dr. Daniel Claiborne, who is, among other things, a forensic psychologist serving as a police psychologist for over 20 law enforcement agencies. In addition, Dr. Claiborne has been an instructor for over 12 years at the Johnson County, Kansas Regional Police Academy. And Dr. Claiborne, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Claiborne, I want to begin with you by asking how the mindset of police officers and about all that, many, if not most, police departments do some sort of psychological assessment when they hire officers. What are some of the traits desired in a candidate for the academy? And I'm wondering, is aggression among them?
Well, yes, almost all states require a psychological evaluation of police officers before they can go to the academy, and then, of course, that means before they can be certified. And we, in our office, we serve for actually more like 60 departments. We have a four-hour test battery and interview process that all the applicants go through, and a number of personality traits and behavioral tendencies are assessed. Aggression and hostility and anger control are among them.
You know, in your work as an instructor, I'm wondering about the overall mindset that is emphasized with cadets. What's the attitude the department wants them to bring to the job?
Well, in our community here, really, and particularly I'm speaking of Johnson County, but even some of the smaller departments in Missouri, too, it's really to be a person in public service. It's not really militaristic or a person out there, you know, chasing bad guys primarily. That's part of the job, but it's really people with social and interpersonal skills. Empathy is very important. Because mostly people are going to be solving problems for citizens at a much lower level of intervention than any kind of aggressiveness.
But I'm wondering about the warrior mentality, Dr. Claiborne, you know, the armored vehicles and the assault rifles. Does that sort of come along once the trappings, all that militarized equipment begins being used?
You know, I have not noticed that with our departments here primarily in Kansas. At all. The attitude of the officers that I work with and evaluate, and I've done this for over 30 years now, is not at all a warrior mentality. It's much more of a protector, community service mentality. The applicants, when they come in, you know, I ask them, you know, what motivates you to be a police officer? And almost universally, they say, you know, they want to help people, they want to get back to the community, that sort of thing.
Ken Novak, let me turn this to you here. Let's look at the methodology we're seeing in Ferguson right now, which has had such a strong show of support, obviously. What's the strategy behind, you know, lining up officers in mass and in full riot gear at a protest, or for that matter, having two patrol cars present at a traffic stop when it only takes one officer to write a ticket? What's behind all that?
Well, Steve, part of the idea behind that is if the law enforcement is able to show force, and that show of force should deter somebody from getting aggressive or running from the police or getting violent with the police.
But it's not happening in Ferguson, though.
It's not happening in Ferguson, and there's a bit of an irony here because the protests associated with Ferguson is in response to aggressive behavior by the police, amongst other things. And that show of force is not achieving what I think it was designed to do. Rational people are upset about the aggressive law enforcement. And when aggressive law enforcement is being met with aggressive law enforcement, then it creates a very volatile situation.
So what do you think is sustaining? We're in our 10th day now of overnight rioting in Ferguson. What is sustaining that, in your view, on behalf of the younger folks who are doing it?
Well, it's very, very interesting and very troubling that, yeah, we're in 9-10 days of this type of violent protest. And it seems that over time, the types of protests, there's been an ebb and flow to it. And most recently, there's reports of quite a few people who were involved in the protests are not from Ferguson or not from St. Louis County. And they're not protesting necessarily their police, but it's a sounding board for a much larger issue within the American conscience.
Yeah. Dr. Claiborne, what do you make of Ferguson? Any thoughts on what you might think is the next logical step on behalf of law enforcement there?
You know, I've watched it and with great interest and kept up with the situation as it's unfolded, but I don't really know that much about that community. It seems as though a lot of this has to do with a history of relations between the police department and the citizens, and also the cultural makeup of the community contrasted with the leadership and power base of the community. But that's just what I've gathered from listening to the news. I don't really know a lot about that community. It doesn't seem to be similar to the communities that our police departments serve over here. But other than that, I don't really have that much insight into it. It is a puzzle.
Doctor, what skills do you think are most crucial for officers in situations like the one that's brewing in Ferguson?
Well, I would say empathy, for one thing. One of the things we've noticed in we do ongoing research constantly in terms of successful officers compared with unsuccessful officers, and one of the dimensions that has become more prominent in the last few years has been empathy. So now we're testing for that in our test batteries, and we're trying to select officers who can really step into the mindset or the shoes of another person, and particularly a person who's different from themselves. So I think, that has become a really important ingredient.
But, Doctor, how important can empathy be in a situation like Ferguson, where the makeup of the police department is so predominantly white and the community is so predominantly black?
I definitely think it's a challenge, but we still look for officers who can identify with people who are different from themselves. And even in our community here, we have many different kind of ethnic minorities, gender differences. And part of our questioning in our interview process is challenging the officers to imagine dealing with citizens who are different from themselves. But but still, I don't know that white officers can completely at all identify with the frustrations and the pressures and the disillusionment of a community like Ferguson.
Let me get our listeners involved here. If you have comments about the situation in Ferguson, how the police are reacting, the kind of officer needed to deal with a situation like the one in Ferguson, 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Ken Novak, what do you make of this notion of what I just asked Dr. Claiborne, the racial differences between the officers and the folks they're overseeing in Ferguson? What about that? How big of a hurdle is that for police to get over?
I think that is a hurdle. I think that's a symbolic hurdle. I think it is, it's a black-white thing. It's a thin blue line of police, us versus them, good versus bad. I think sometimes we can make a little bit too much of the racial makeup of a police department. Research has demonstrated that, citizens tend to not rate white officers or black officers any higher, and actually the most preferred dyad that officers engage in is a symbolic one white officer, one black officer when dealing with citizens.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does matter to some extent, but that's not a panacea. It's merely part of the overall conversation.
And Ken, I noticed from my own history covering the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department back in the 80s that recruiting officers of color was a huge challenge for that department. And I assume it continues to be today, given the percentage of black officers here in Kansas City compared to the overall black population.
It's a challenge for all law enforcement departments. And the question
is that why is it a challenge?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, the knee jerk reaction could be that qualified black candidates are screened out. And that may be the case in some situations.
Screened out why?
For one reason or another. If you're talking about a racial amicus of making sure that policing has historically been a white male-dominated occupation, and because of the thin blue line, a we versus them, maybe there's a little bit of the, if you don't fit the characteristics of the existing police department, maybe inadvertently sometimes that people may be screened out. But I think more importantly, what we're seeing in Ferguson is how attractive would a career in law enforcement be for a young person of color. And I think that that's a larger hurdle, is attracting qualified individuals to pursue that as a career when there are histories of animosity between the police and the public. And we're largely talking about the minority public.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Claiborne, go ahead. Yes. Hop in here. Yeah.
I wanted to reinforce what Dr. Novak said. The departments that I work with all over the state of Kansas and in Missouri are desperate to have minority officers. There's not even a remote question of screening them out. They'll do everything they can to attract their attention, to recruit them. This is not just true of African Americans, but also Hispanic people and women and getting them into law enforcement, Spanish-speaking people. But it's very difficult, I think, as Dr. Novak mentioned. It may have to do with the perception of minorities of a career in law enforcement. I'm not sure why it's so difficult, but the departments are actually aggressive about wanting minority officers.
That's my sense, too. Again, if you're joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the militarization of police departments across the country and in Missouri and Kansas in the wake of the Ferguson crisis. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Sam from Overland Park. Sam, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for the show. My question would be, I've heard nothing in the media about any of the roles or the speaking out for the local leadership, the mayor, the office kind of thing. I would expect that if it's something like this would go on in Kansas City, we'd have a large mayoral presence. Does one of your guests have something that we just haven't heard about, or is there another reason that there is no reporting on the local leadership? And I'll take that offline.
Thank you. Sam, thank you. Ken Novak, why aren't we hearing more from the mayor of Ferguson? Any sense? And should we be?
I think we definitely should be. And I think one of the ways that to mend the fences here is to get local community leaders and political leaders at the forefront to make sure that protesters can be heard and be heard in a peaceful way, and that law enforcement can keep the peace and just to bridge that gap between law enforcement and the public. I think that's part of the role of local politicians and community leaders.
Dr. Claiborne?
Yes, I second that. I think as the president tried to do it, tried to emphasize this is a time for listening and understanding and probing deeper in terms of what the frustrations and what the point the protesters are trying to make, what that really is and where those frustrations come from. And it really is time for listening. And also listening to the perspective of the police department and the human beings that are police officers. Hmm.
William from Kansas City, Kansas, you're on Up to Date. William, good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
Hey, I was just kind of curious as to why, you know, whenever we're dealing with these types of issues in general, we're so quick to jump to black and white, and we don't address it from a constitutional perspective. You know, even when the officer shot the kid, I mean, he was judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, that goes against our Constitution. Hmm. It just seems like we're so quick to jump into race that we don't even allow democracy to work.
Hmm. William, thank you. Ken, are we moved too quickly to the race, play the race card too quickly in this controversy in Ferguson or not?
I think the black-white issue is a convenient label. I think that there's other things involved here. There's economics. There's community disorganization and deprivation. I think there's an age thing. It's not. It's a young black male. There's a gender thing involved here. But William's comment about the Constitution is it's spot on. It's about due process, both for the victim and both for the officer, and as well as the protesters, to peaceably assemble.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when there is an officer involved shooting, the due process is potentially compromised. But that is, you know, that's a reality which we live in. But the Constitution needs to be the guiding document for all of these types of things. Absolutely.
Dr. Claiborne, Karen has written us at KCUR UpToDate, or you can also email us updatedatkcur.org. She wants to know, what's the importance of having officers that come from the community they police? What about that?
I think it's very important. Could I say one thing about the constitutional issue first?
Yeah.
I really have a different perspective on that. I think when an officer is involved in an immediate critical incident situation, and their life is in danger, they perceive it that way, it isn't really a constitutional situation at all. These things happen in a matter of seconds. Officers have intense and lengthy training, and at those moments, their training kicks in. They react automatically. They do the things that they've been taught to keep themselves safe, and they escalate force quickly if they have to. These things just happen in seconds. This issue of denying the suspect his constitutional rights and laying that at the feet of the police officer, I think, is misguided.
Hmm.
I just needed to say that. Of course, I'm defending the police officers because I really work with them and support them and select them. But I felt like that needed to
yeah.
be said.
But
I understand what the person's asking about in terms of due process, but that comes above and beyond the role of the human being in those few seconds of a conflict on the street.
And you're saying it also goes without saying, to Karen's point about having officers that come from the community they police, that's always a benefit in your mind?
Yes. I've never seen that be a disadvantage. We look for that. As a matter of fact, we have a luxury, most of our officers, applicants here in Kansas, that they do come either from the community itself or from surrounding communities, so they're familiar with the culture, the Midwestern ideas, But a lot of times they're from the very city that they're applying for.
Yeah. Ken Novak, I wanted to ask about the chain of command over in Ferguson. Obviously, we have the local police. Governor Nixon weighed in and put the Highway Patrol in charge of the situation there. And now you have the National Guard that's been mobilized on top of that. Do you have any thoughts, any concerns about the chain of command, and if there's any confusion there with all these different agencies bearing down, including now the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder coming now to Missouri, I believe, tomorrow to take a firsthand look?
Yeah, there is a potentially a chain of command issue, and I think it's more of a question of why the shifting of responsibility from Ferguson PD or St. Louis County to the state, and then bringing in the National Guard. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that whoever's in charge, I mean, the way that the chain of command works is that, you know, they're in charge, and that leadership will prevail in terms of the officers on the street of what they should be doing or what they're ordered to do and whatnot. But the conversation will also become later as to why that's necessary. Why is mm-hmm. it necessary here? Was the timing of it correct? And I don't have an answer to that. I mean, that could be very subjective, I think, and be part of the conversation moving forward.
Okay. Sharon from Kansas City, Missouri. Sharon, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. My comment is I just wanted to let all the listeners know that Chief Daryl Forte has announced that all Kansas City patrol divisions will be open this evening from 6 to 8. We'll host an open house, of course, and that all neighbors and businesses, communities are invited to attend that. So it's an opportunity for that relationship and community building that is so critical at this time.
Okay. Sharon, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Doctor, this continuing escalation of force has got to be taking its toll on the officers who've been on the scene since Michael Brown was shot. Have you dealt with officers who have faced similar situations, and what's it like for them?
Oh, yes. We have, with all the departments we work with, I see an officer involved in a shooting probably every other week or so. And it's really a tough thing for them. No, in my experience, none of the officers want to be involved in a shooting. It's a last resort event. They have difficulty with it afterwards often. Their families have difficulty with it. And now, with the extra layer on, in terms of everyone's awareness about what's happening in Ferguson, officers on the street today are also in the back of their mind thinking, gosh, if I have to take an action like this, what is my community going to think of it? And that stress has always been there, but now it's accentuated. I just met with an officer recently who had that in his mind, that he had an incident, he had to shoot somebody, but partly what he was thinking about in the back of his mind was, I wonder what the press will do. I wonder how the community will react to this. Even though the incident itself, he felt, was completely straightforward and justified, and he did what he felt he had to do to protect himself and his partner. But this consciousness of Ferguson, and I think eventually it may be a healthy thing, but right now it's really a stressful thing for the police officers.
I was going to say, and how would you imagine then, Dr. Claiborne, how is the officer who fired the fatal shots, how is he being handled these days in the wake of this thing? What do you think's going on there?
Well, just traditionally, when an officer is involved in a shooting, that person's placed on administrative leave. The department or another department comes and begins an investigation that lasts several weeks, usually involves a district attorney's office, and that officer stays off duty with his weapon removed from him until that investigation is completely finished. And for the first part of that time, he's even prevented, or she, from talking with other officers about the event, so that no one contaminates their evidence with the stories of another person.
Right.
So it's very frustrating for the officer to be in this limbo for a period of time, even if the event was completely justified and straightforward. So often the officers feel like they're being punished, or at least held in abeyance until they're almost guilty until proven innocent. So it's very stressful on them, and officers who haven't been involved in shootings know that if they are, this is partly what they can expect. So it's just another layer of negative anticipation that they have to deal with.
Paul from Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, go quickly if you would.
I'm wondering how the issue of race can be avoided when you compare the reaction of law enforcement in the Bundy standoff, where you had armed white people pointing their weapons at authorities, compared to the military type response of to peaceful protesters in St. Louis. Or
can we give a quick reaction from you, if I could?
And yeah, the racial aspect is a easy way to delineate between those two things. And you know, the question becomes: is all else being equal, do police react the same regardless of citizen race? And, you know, we can make some generalizations in that regard, and that might be a little dangerous to do so. But your caller brings up a good point.
Well, Brent,
I think it really has more to do with power.
All right.
Than race, though.
We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our two guests, Ken Novak, a professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at UMKC. Dr. Dan Claiborne is a counseling and forensics psychologist with Claiborne and Associates. Thank you both for coming on today. Good conversation.
You're welcome.
Thank you.